Welcome to Immigration Nerds. This podcast is for everyone seeking the details, context, and facts behind the banner headlines on immigration. It's the podcast that gives you the latest on immigration policy and politics and the real-world impacts on the people and businesses that make our world turn. If you believe immigration makes us all better, then this is the podcast for you. Brought to you by the nerds at Erickson Immigration Group, guiding clients and their employees through the complex immigration system for over 20 years.
Hello, immigration nerds. I'm Lauren Clark, senior attorney at Erickson Immigration Group. I am a fellow nerd, an immigrant, and host of this amazing podcast. In every episode, we're joined by the smartest nerds in the know as we cover trends in business, culture, technology, and politics at the intersection of global immigration. Today, we have a terrific show for you as we explore a beautiful symbol of cultural exchange and an enduring connection between the people of Japan and America. It is a story of how immigration is not just about the movement of people, but also about the migration of ideas that enrich our lives. The tradition of celebrating the blooming of the cherry trees in Japan is centuries old. The planting of the cherry trees in Washington, D.C. originated in 1912 as a gift of friendship to the people of the United States from the people of Japan. And as we record this episode, the 2024 Washington cherry blossom season is underway. But how did it really come to pass? And why is this story so appropriate for us to consider during Women's History Month? Nerds, coming up in just a few minutes, we're joined by Diana Parcell, author of the book, Eliza Sidmore, the trailblazing journalist behind Washington's cherry trees. But first, as always, we bring you the latest immigration news to be aware of. And for that, we turn to our news nerd-in-chief, Erickson Immigration Group partner, Rob Taylor. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Lauren. How are you today?
I am great. Can you tell us what is topping the news list today?
Sure. Well, as you know, spring is in the air, and with each spring comes H-1B cap season. We are currently in the midst of the H-1B cap registration process. I think we talked about previously that opened up on March the 6th and closes on March the 22nd. So anyone who is interested in sponsoring a foreign national for an H-1B visa, that registration needs to be submitted by the 22nd, noon Eastern time. I think you've been involved some this year with the H-1B cap registration process, the new organizational accounts. How's that gone from your side?
Surprisingly well, considering the number of changes that we have seen for this cap season. There has definitely been a lot of improvements, which we are loving as legal practitioners within the cap season. But it will be interesting to see how the selection rates go this year with the changes, something maybe to report on in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think having done this for a long time, any changes that are good are very welcome. And so I think we are seeing some positive updates and changes from the government and really hope to see a higher selection rate, just a more streamlined process. And time will tell, but I think everyone's optimistic about how things have gone so far this year.
And speaking of changes, I know that there are a number of other USCIS changes coming up in the near future.
Yeah, starting on April the 1st, there's going to be some new forms that roll out, specifically with regards to business immigration, the I-129 and the I-140. I think it's important for folks to keep in mind that oftentimes when the government rolls out new forms, they offer a grace period, you know, saying maybe for the next 30, 60, 90 days, you can submit either the old form or the new form. But with these changes, starting on April the 1st, they're only going to be accepting the new I-129 and the new I-140. So folks need to make sure that they submit the correct form as of April the 1st. And in addition to that, there's also going to be fee increases that go into effect on April the 1st. So not only do you need to make sure you get the right form filed, but you also need to make sure that you submit the correct amount for the filing.
And are there any other news items for us today, Rob?
Just a few others. First, the April visa bulletin came out. Historically, we don't see a lot of movement from month to month, but there was a bit of movement in the EB1 category for Indian nationals. So that was a welcome update. One thing that we have been tracking for a while is a government shutdown. That's been avoided, and so we're glad to know that things will continue to run and operate, no further delays, either with the Department of Labor or at consulates with the Department of State. And then lastly, the president, along with the budget, did request some funds and plans to proceed with additional security at the border, which also includes new in law enforcement. So we'll see how that shapes out over the next several months, but that's something that we'll be keeping an eye on.
Well, thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you. It's great to be here again.
And And now for a conversation with author Diana Parcell about the life of Eliza Sidmore, a woman born in the American Midwest in 1856, who made her first trip to Japan in the summer of 1885. Diana, thank you for joining us on the Immigration Nerds podcast.
It's a delight to be here, Lauren. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
Of course. Now, in your book, Diana, you paint an extraordinary picture of Eliza Sidmore's life and her impact on the now famous cherry trees that live along the tidal basin on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Can you begin by sharing with our audience what those cherry trees symbolize and why the truth of their history in the United States captivates you?
Cherry trees, to start off, are not unique to Japan, as a lot of people assume. Cherry trees grew wild in the mountains of many areas of Southeast Asia for centuries, and they were really associated with Shinto and Buddhist religions later on, but early on, it was thought that spirits resided in nature, and it has to do with ancestor worship. And also, going to those trees in the mountains in the springtime to celebrate the trees, to celebrate this idea of the cycle of nature, really the oneness of people and nature, that everything is related to a continuous cycle of birth and death and regeneration. So this was really how this interest in the cherry blossoms originated. People in China had done that with plum blossoms for centuries, and then the Japanese kind of picked up on doing this with cherry trees in particular because of their beauty. And so over time, these trees came to represent different levels of meaning in Japan, but especially the idea that the fragility and the brevity of cherry blossoms really represents the impermanence of life. This brief burst of glory, followed by death, makes our own experience of them, you know, really wonderful and joyful, but also melancholy and poignant, because even as we're enjoying them, we are aware of the brief span of their life.
The cherry trees really do have that beautiful symbolism that you've captured so well. Is that the tree and what it symbolizes, what drew you into kind of researching and understanding their history in the United States?
No, my interest in it was accidental in this story, because I was living in Indonesia over 20 years ago with my husband, and I bought a book called Java, the Garden of the East. And it was a paperback reprint of a book that had been published in 1897. I carried it home. I picked it up off the shelf a few years later. I dipped into it and I found it totally engrossing. It related to a lot of the experiences I myself had had in Java. I was impressed with the vividness of the descriptions and how well-informed the author was, and also the voice of the author I found rather beguiling. So I went and I did a quick internet search, and I was stunned to discover that the author of this book was an American woman who had traveled extensively. She had a 40-year career as a journalist. She was the first woman elected to the board of National Geographic in 1892. And then I read in this very brief entry that she is the one that introduced the idea of bringing those cherry trees to Washington. And I was stunned, because I had gone every year. I lived here over 30 years. I'd gone every year to see those trees, and I had never heard her name. So I was totally curious. First of all, who was she? How did she get this idea for the trees? But also, I was totally drawn to the idea of how did a woman of this era achieve all those things she did. So I came at it not just from the cherry trees, but also curiosity about the story of this woman who did remarkable things and then fell into basically obscurity for the next century.
That discovery leads very nicely into the next question, which was, in the book, you bring your readers into the culture and traditions of 19th century Japan through the eyes of Eliza And you describe her as a trailblazer who melded the traits of journalist, explorer, geographer, and ethnographer, environmentalist, advocate of world peace, and collector of Oriental art. How were you, from this discovery of this book in Java, able to then uncover all of the amazing detail about her life and her story with the cherry trees?
Back in Washington, one of the advantages of living here is having access to the extraordinary Library of Congress. So I started going there just to see what I could find out. And at first it was very little. I found her books, copies of 7 books she wrote on Alaska, Japan, Java, China, India. So this was a great place to start. I found her listed in 2 dozen biographical indexes, which told me she was a very important woman in her day. I also found some of her early journalism, but I found almost nothing on her personal life. So it was just a matter of starting to dig and to follow one clue after another. And I will mention that it took me almost 10 years to write the book because so little was known about her. And if you know anything about writing biography, you know that you have to go to track down sources, both primary and secondary sources. And it took a lot of digging to uncover a lot of those records. And gradually, I was able to find a remarkable record of her journalism, over 800 newspaper and magazine articles she wrote in her lifetime. This had never been revealed before. Also, that enabled me then to start putting, you know, because of datelines, I was able to put together a chronology of her life for the first time. And that gave me the backbone of the book, where I could begin to follow her travels and to track her adventures around the world. So I've mentioned Alaska. She went to Alaska as a young journalist in her 20s. In 1883, when Alaska had only been part of the United States for 16 years, she was inspired by the travels of John Muir, who had traveled to Alaska to study glaciers. So she followed in his footsteps, went to Alaska, 6 times, actually, and ended up writing the first travel guide to Alaska. Similarly, she was a real trailblazer in reporting on Japan. That came about because she had a brother who worked as a consular officer in Japan for almost 40 years. Her mother, their mother, moved to Japan to live with a son. So suddenly, Eliza has a part-time home in Japan, and she comes and goes for years and years. And this, of course, is what led her to become an expert on the Japanese and Japanese culture and to come up with the idea for the cherry trees in Washington.
And so it's in chapter 8 of your book, you speak about Eliza's singular vision and how she appreciated the way cherry blossoms bridge the gap between old and new in the Japanese Imperium. Was Eliza taking the long view of history with her vision of cherry blossoms in Washington, D.C.?
I don't think it was a long vision. I think it was simply a practical vision. She had grown up in Washington, D.C. She grew to love the city as her adopted home. She watched the transformation of Washington over the years. She reported on Washington development as a young reporter. And the story is essentially that she came to Washington as a young child during the Civil War. And it was a very shabby, rundown, small southern town, essentially, very underdeveloped. But over the years, it was, you know, it was the nation's capital, but it was really an embarrassment to many people because of its shabby condition. So Washington underwent several waves of development. I think it was in the 1870s, they had a huge campaign where they put in sidewalks and they street lights and they covered up a smelly canal that ran through the middle of town and they planted thousands and thousands of trees. So here we have this beginning of this transformation or beautification of Washington into a capital that Americans could be proud of. So there were a number of waves like this, and one of those waves entailed taking this section of town that was south and west of the Washington Monument that was on the riverbank of the Potomac. It was a very marshy, smelly, nasty part of town. People complained for years. So finally, in the 1880s, the Army Corps of Engineers started filling in that ground. They took soil that they dredged from the bottom of the Potomac and they raised the level of that ground, because up until then, the Potomac River would blow almost to the base of the monument. So by doing this, by reclaiming this land, they decided they would turn it into a public park. And it was a very revealing moment in my research when I was reading Eliza's early journalism, and one of these columns that she reported for a newspaper she was writing for in St. Louis, she described a day in November 1883, when she went down to the mall to report on this new park development. She actually went to the top of the unfinished Washington Monument using this platform elevator that the workmen used to carry the stones to the top. She reached the top and she described looking out over this project and said in her column, you know, this is one day going to be the largest and most beautiful public park in Washington. She used these words, it will be a place of magnificence in future administrations. She had not even gone to Japan yet at this point. But what this told me was already we have the seeds of what would become her vision, because when she went to Japan starting in 1885, she experienced the cherry blossoms there. She said, why don't we have these in America? What better place to introduce them to Americans than in Washington? And I have a spot in mind. So this really was fascinating to me because I felt it represented the very beginnings of her vision.
And as you just mentioned, Eliza Sidmore was a journalist. Her travels were extensive, and clearly she had this vision from, like you said, this seed of what the basin is going to be. And we also indicate that Eliza is an important female figure, and she wasn't the only female alone in bringing or essentially creating the basin as it is today. Diana, can you tell us about her personal relationship with Helen Taft?
Yes, Helen Taft turned out to be an important ally of Eliza in bringing the trees to Washington, because Eliza had come back from Japan. She had approached those men who were in charge of building this new park and said, we should create a park of cherry trees. And they listened to her and then they ignored her. And that happened several times in different administrations over a period of almost 25 years. Finally, we have a turning point when the Tafts came to the White House. They were both interested in the development of Potomac Park, and Helen Taft in particular had an idea where she was a musician by training and wanted to create a bandstand along the riverfront that would be a public gathering places for people from all walks of life. So the news about this got out. Eliza hears it and she realizes Mrs. Taft's idea and plan really intersects very closely with her idea of creating a cherry tree park along the river. So she writes to Mrs. Taft and asks for her support to include some cherry trees. And Mrs. Taft jumped on the idea. So Mrs. Taft had actually met the Sidmores a number of times in Japan. Mrs. Taft herself lived in Japan. That was a fun part of the book, discovering the summer that she actually lived in Japan, and she wrote about in her memoir. So Helen Taft appreciated this influence of Japanese culture. So she jumped onto that idea. So Eliza had the idea and Mrs. Taft had the clout that it took to break through this barrier of obstruction and to actually bring the cherry trees. Also, I want to add that it was Eliza's contacts with high-level Japanese that really elevated the project from this simple idea when she ran into a Japanese chemist, visiting in Washington at the time for social events. She tells him of Mrs. Taft's plans. He immediately offers to donate 2,000 trees to Mrs. Taft. And then it turned out that the Japanese decided to give that as a gift of friendship to Washington. If you know the story, the first batch of trees arrived in 1910. The U.S. Department of Agriculture inspected them and said, oh, these trees are infested with pests and full of diseases. We can't allow these trees to be planted because they will be a threat to U.S. agriculture. And all those trees were burned. So that was 1910. The Japanese very graciously said, we will send you a replacement batch of trees. They will be grown by horticultural experts in Japan. They will be grown under pristine conditions. So they turned around and sent another batch of trees in 1912, 3,000 trees, in fact. And those were the beginnings of the trees that we now have today in Washington. I love the story of how they put together a very small private dedication ceremony because the trees came late. They weren't sure about their condition. They had to inspect them in a hurry. And then the White House put together a very small dedication ceremony. Mrs. Taft was there, March 27th, 1912, standing on the banks of the tidal basin. She invited three guests to witness the planting of those first two trees. Those guests were the Japanese ambassador and his wife, and Eliza Sidmore. So she was there to witness the realization of this idea that she had nurtured in her mind for almost 30 years. So I love that story.
And it's a beautiful kind of full circle moment from Eliza. For anyone who's been to the basin, you know, the beauty of those trees is really unmatched. And we're currently on watch for a peak bloom about to happen. So for anyone in the DC area, it's something to check out. Diana, what lessons do you think we can all take from Eliza during the fact that this is Women's History Month, but also about the cultural exchange and the power of immigration?
Well, I think the biggest point is that immigration is not just about the movement of people. It is also about the migration of ideas, and this really enriches our lives. I've mentioned that I did a lot of my research at the Library of Congress as an outgrowth of that. It became such a special place to me that I now volunteer there. And when you work there, you realize what an astounding repository of knowledge from literature, art, scientific and intellectual ideas from around the world that add up to this knowledge that really helped fuel the advancement of civilization over the centuries. So in this sense, immigration and cultural exchange is really fundamentally a cross-fertilization of people and ideas from around the world. So I think that's a larger lesson to take away from all of this.
I would 100% agree, and I love that every year the cherry blossoms give us a very beautiful time to celebrate that cultural exchange. Diana Purcell, author of the book Eliza Sidmore, the trailblazing journalist behind Washington's cherry trees, thank you so much for being our guest on the Immigration Nerds podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Lauren. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
And nerds, you can find a link to Diana's book and other information about the cherry trees on the National Mall in our show notes. And you can always find more information at our Erickson Immigration Group website, eiglaw.com. And remember, if you believe immigration makes us all better, then this is the podcast for you. Subscribe and meet us right back here for another new episode of Immigration Nerds.